Hello, my name's Donald Fons. I'm the staff historian here at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. For the next 2 hours, I'd like to lead you on a tour of Wilderness Battlefield, the opening contest of the 1864 Overland Campaign, and the first battle featuring the war's two greatest generals, Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee. The tour consists of 10 different stops. At the end of each stop, there will be instructions on how to reach the next stop on the tour. Turn off your player until you reach the next stop, and then turn your player back on. Many of the tour stops that you'll visit are also stops on the general driving tour. The two are not exactly the same, however, so for the purposes of this tour, ignore the round brown tour signs that you'll see and rely instead on the verbal instructions on this podcast. One final word of caution. Portions of this tour follow heavily traveled public roads. When driving on these roads, keep up your speed and use your turn signals. Now let's begin our tour. By 1864, the Civil War had been going on for 3 years. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers had perished, and still there was no end in sight. In November, the people of the North would go to the polls to elect a new president. If Abraham Lincoln did not win the war by then, or at least show substantial progress toward winning it, war-weary voters might well elect a peace candidate to negotiate an end to the fighting. Recognizing the need for new, more vigorous leadership, Lincoln in April of 1864 appointed Ulysses S. Grant General-in-Chief over Union armies throughout the nation and gave him a free hand to manage the war as he saw fit. Grant had defeated several Confederate armies in the West, but how he would fare against Lee remained to be seen. Grant recognized that the North had ample men and resources to defeat the South, but that it had not used those resources effectively. The armies in the East and West acted independently and without concert, like a balky team of horses, he later wrote, no two ever pulling together. I therefore determined, first, to use the greatest number of troops practicable against the armed force of the enemy, second, to hammer continuously against the armed force of the enemy and his resources, until by mere attrition, if in no other way, there should be nothing left to him. Grant determined to attack the South simultaneously on several fronts, knowing that the Confederates, with their limited resources, would not be able to respond to each one. In Virginia, he decided to employ General George Gordon Meade's Army of the Potomac against Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. While Meade engaged Lee in battle near Fredericksburg, smaller armies led by Generals Benjamin Butler and Franz Sigel would capture Lee's two primary sources of supply, Richmond to the south and the Shenandoah Valley to the west. Outnumbered and deprived of the materials necessary to wage war, Lee would have no choice but to surrender. For the plan to work, the Army of the Potomac had to keep Lee pinned down so that he could not dispatch reinforcements to fight Butler and Sigel. Grant attached himself to Meade's army to make sure that it fought to its full potential. For the next 12 months, until Lee's army surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse, the Army of the Potomac would, for all practical purposes, become Grant's army. Now, get into your car and drive to the Wilderness Battlefield. If you're beginning your tour at the Chancellorsville Visitor Center, leave the parking lot by the exit closest to the building. Turn left onto Bulk Road and proceed a few yards to the stop sign at State Route 3. Turn right onto Route 3, be mindful of the traffic, and drive 4.4 miles to the stoplight at Route 20, the Orange Turnpike. Turn left at the light and drive 4/10 of a mile to a pull-off on the right side of the road. Remain in your car. Stop number 1. Grant's Knoll. Grant set May 4, 1864 as the date to begin the Union advance. At midnight, the Army of the Potomac quietly left its camps in Culpeper County and began making its way south toward the Rapidan River, 4 miles to your right. Meade had divided the army into four corps, a cavalry corps led by General Philip Sheridan, and three infantry corps led by Generals Winfield Hancock, Gouverneur Warren, and John Sedgwick. On the eve of the campaign, General Ambrose Burnside's Independent Ninth Corps reinforced the Army of the Potomac, boosting the number of Northern soldiers to 120,000 men. To supply this vast host, Union quartermasters assembled a wagon train that, if placed end to end, would have stretched for 60 miles, from here all the way back to Washington, D.C. General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia had spent the winter camped in Orange County, south of the Rapidan River. Rather than attack Lee's riverfront defenses head-on, Meade decided to cross the Rapidan River at Germanna Ford, well beyond Lee's right flank, and advance into a gloomy, heavily wooded region known as the Wilderness. Once there, he would wheel his army to the right and attack the Confederates at Mine Run, a creek located 6 miles ahead of you, where he believed Lee would make his stand. General James Wilson's cavalry division led the Union march. It was Wilson's job to conceal the Army's movements from Lee and to warn Meade of any Confederate approach. He failed on both counts. Upon reaching the Orange Turnpike, Wilson's cavalry turned right and headed past this spot to Locust Grove, 4 miles ahead of you. Finding no Confederates there, it turned south and headed for the Orange Plank Road, leaving this road, the Orange Turnpike, unguarded. Meanwhile, General Gouverneur Warren's 5th Corps crossed Germanna Ford in Wilson's wake and advanced to Wilderness Tavern, 1/2 mile to your left rear. Although several hours of daylight remained, Meade ordered Warren to halt at the tavern so that his corps would not outpace the Army's cumbersome wagon train, which was still crossing the river. As a precaution, Warren posted General Charles Griffin's division in this vicinity to guard the turnpike. The next morning, as Warren prepared to resume his march through the wilderness, Griffin's pickets reported the approach of a large Confederate force on the turnpike, less than a mile ahead. According to a staff officer, Warren never received a greater shock in his life. He had assumed that Wilson had established cavalry pickets on the turnpike to warn him of an enemy advance from that direction. To his dismay, he now discovered that wasn't the case. Warren immediately notified Meade that he had spotted the Confederates on the turnpike and was preparing to meet them in combat. Meade found the news annoying rather than alarming. Convinced that Lee would not venture beyond Mine Run, Meade dismissed the Confederate force in Warren's front as nothing more than a small body of men sent by Lee to delay his march through the wilderness. Wishing to impress Grant with his aggression, Meade ordered Warren to attack the Confederates and destroy them. Grant concurred with Meade's decision. However, the close confines of the wilderness made it difficult for Warren to execute Meade's orders. By the time Grant reached the front 5 hours later, Warren still had not attacked. In fact, Charles Griffin was urging Warren to postpone his attack until the 6th Corps could reach the battlefield and cover his right flank. Grant had no patience with delays and ordered Meade to attack at once. While Warren made final arrangements for the assault, Grant and Meade established their headquarters here, next to the Orange Turnpike. For the next 3 days, the small knoll to your right, which was open at the time, would become the headquarters of not only the Army of the Potomac, but of Union armies throughout the country. The spot hummed with activity as staff officers and couriers delivered a steady stream of messages from the front less than a mile away. George Meade, high-strung and irascible, kept in constant motion. Grant, by contrast, appeared calm, but his constant whittling and smoking showed that he, too, felt the strain. To the right of the sign is a short path that leads to the site of Grant's and Meade's headquarters. Once you've visited the site, return to your car and drive 1.2 miles to the Wilderness Exhibit Shelter. On the way, you'll pass a sign for Elwood, a farmhouse used by General Warren as his headquarters. If you wish to visit the house, turn left at the sign. You'll encounter a gate a short way in. If the gate's open, you can drive back to the house. Otherwise, park your car at the gate, being careful not to block the entrance, and walk the 1/4 mile distance to the building. Once you've walked around the house and visited the cemetery, which holds what remains of General Stonewall Jackson's amputated left arm, resume your tour by turning left onto Route 20 and proceeding to the Wilderness Exhibit Shelter. When you reach the shelter, step out and read the exhibits, then face the highway and turn your player back on. Stop number 2, the Wilderness Exhibit Shelter. The South approached the spring campaign with determination, if not optimism. 1863 had been a bad year for Confederate armies throughout the country. May had seen the death of Stonewall Jackson at Chancellorsville. July had brought surrender at Vicksburg and defeat at Gettysburg, and November had ended with another Confederate loss at Chattanooga. There had been problems off the battlefield as well. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation had scuttled any hopes the South might have entertained of foreign intervention in the war, and the Union Navy's blockade of the southern coastline made it difficult for the South to sell its cotton or to import foreign goods. As a result, supplies became scarce and prices rose. Confederate currency became inflated to the point of being almost without value. Worse still, the South had all but exhausted its available supply of manpower. From then on, when it lost soldiers in battle, it would not be able to replace them. As conditions in the South deteriorated, its people looked to General Robert E. Lee and his Army of Northern Virginia for victory on the battlefield. If Lee could defeat the Army of the Potomac, as he had done in previous years, the Northern people might tire of the war and vote Abraham Lincoln out of office, electing a peace candidate in his stead. But to defeat the Union Army, Lee would have to overcome great odds. When the campaign began, the Confederate commander had 65,000 men, just one soldier for every 2 in the Army of the Potomac. He had beaten such odds before, though, and was confident he could do so again. Indeed, he had no choice but to win, for defeat would mean certain doom for the Confederacy. "Colonel, we have got to whip them," Lee told a member of his staff. "We must whip them, and it has already made me better to think of it." Lee divided his army into three infantry corps. James Longstreet led the first corps, Richard Ewell the second, and A.P. Hill the third. General Jeb Stuart commanded the army's cavalry. On May 2nd, Lee met with his generals on Clark's Mountain, halfway between here and Orange. As they gazed across the Rapidan River toward the enemy camps in Culpeper County, Lee predicted that Grant would cross at Germanna Ford beyond his right flank. Signalmen on Clark's Mountain confirmed his prediction 3 days later. As soon as he learned that the Union Army was heading for Germanna Ford, Lee put his army in motion to intercept the enemy. Rather than halting at Mine Run, as his opponents expected, Lee pushed eastward, hoping to trap the Army of the Potomac in the wilderness. By fighting in the wilderness, Lee hoped to offset the North's advantages in artillery, cavalry, and infantry. The Union Army had more cannon than Lee, but it could not use them in wooded areas. It had more horsemen than Lee, but horses could not operate in the wilderness's brush-choked thickets. Even its 2-to-1 advantage in infantry would be largely negated. Foot soldiers found it hard to maneuver in the woods, and as Lee had shown at Chancellorsville, a smaller force might easily surprise and rout a larger one there. In short, by fighting in the wilderness, Lee could level the playing field between the two armies. Attacking Grant there was not without risk, however. Only Ewell and Hill were within striking distance of the Federal Army. Longstreet was still a day's march behind. If he wished to strike Grant in the wilderness, Lee would have to do so initially with just 2 of his 3 infantry corps. Even those would not be up to full strength. Fearing that the enemy might try to cross the Rapidan River in his rear, Lee ordered both Hill and Ewell to leave large detachments back in Orange County. As a result, he would have just 40,000 men to engage the enemy in the wilderness on May 5th, 1 soldier for every 3 that Grant could bring to bear. It was a huge gamble, but Lee boldly accepted the risk. As soon as he learned that the Union Army was crossing the river at Germanna Ford, he went out to meet it. Confederate troops marching past the Mine Run defenses looked at one another with a smile. "Marse Bob is going for them this time," they remarked. Lee advanced eastward in 2 columns. Ewell's corps took the Orange Turnpike in front of you, while A.P. Hill's corps followed the Orange Plank Road 3 miles farther south. Lee wanted his generals to engage the enemy and prevent him from leaving the wilderness, but he admonished them to avoid a pitched battle until the following day, when the rest of the army would arrive. Such a strategy might have worked with the Army of the Potomac's former leaders, but not with Grant. As soon as he learned that the Confederate Army had advanced beyond Mine Run, the Union commander ordered Meade to attack. The opening engagement took place here, in Saunders Field. At 1 p.m., Warren's 5th Corps, 30,000 strong, charged out of the woods on your left and swept across this field, engaging the Confederates in battle in the woods to your right. Caught off guard by the sudden assault, Ewell's men momentarily gave way, but Confederate reinforcements counterattacked and restored the line. Just before the Union troops fell back, 2 guns of Captain William Shelton's 1st New York Artillery moved forward to support the attack. Shelton galloped down the turnpike and unhitched his cannons just to the right of the shallow ravine in front of you. The Confederates swarmed down the hill from your right to capture the guns, wounding Shelton and killing many of his horses. Before they could bring the guns back to their own lines, however, a fresh Union brigade emerged from the woods to your left and drove the Confederates back to cover. For the next 2 days, Shelton's guns lay silent between the lines, neither side being able to retrieve them. Unable to break Ewell's line with a frontal assault here on the turnpike, Meade sent General John Sedgwick's 6th Corps down the Culpeper Mine Road in an effort to turn Ewell's left flank in the woods behind you. Ewell received timely warning of Sedgwick's approach, however, and sent General Jubal Early's division to meet it. Sedgwick collided with Early late in the afternoon. The 2 generals battled one another until nightfall, with neither side gaining an advantage. The following day, Grant shifted his attacks to the Orange Plank Road. Here on the turnpike, things remained relatively calm until late afternoon, when an attack by General John Gordon stirred things up. Gordon held a position on the far left end of the Confederate line, in the woods about 2 miles to your rear. Early in the day, Gordon examined the ground in front of him and discovered that his brigade overlapped the end of the Union line. Eagerly, he asked Ewell and Early for permission to attack the enemy flank. They refused. The generals had no troops to support Gordon's attack. Moreover, a large body of Union troops, possibly Burnside's 9th Corps, had been reported near the Rapidan River and might descend on Gordon's rear. The flanker might find himself outflanked. Disappointed, Gordon returned to his command. As the day wore on, however, the situation changed. Lee had his hands full down on the Plank Road and was urging Ewell to attack the Federals here on the Turnpike as a diversion. The Ninth Corps, meanwhile, had appeared in the gap between the Turnpike and the Plank Road, rather than on Ewell's left. Gordon was therefore in no danger of being flanked. Finally, about midday, General Robert Johnson's brigade reached the battlefield. Johnson's arrival gave Ewell additional troops with which to make the attack. Daylight remained a problem, however. Even with Johnston's troops, Ewell would have just two brigades to commit to the attack. If he attacked during the day, the Federals would recognize the weakness of his force and might be able to defeat it. Ewell decided to withhold his blow until sunset. An attack at that hour might instill panic in the Union Army's ranks and lead to a rout. On the other hand, if the attack failed, Ewell's men could withdraw safely under the cover of darkness. Gordon's and Johnston's men advanced just before sunset. Caught off guard, Union soldiers in the woods behind you broke ranks and fled, spreading panic down the line as they went. The Confederates surged after them, screaming the rebel yell. By the time darkness brought an end to the fighting, an hour later, the Confederates had bagged several hundred prisoners, including two Union generals. But Gordon was not satisfied. To the end of his days, he insisted that he could have routed the enemy and driven them across the river, had his superiors only allowed him to make the attack earlier in the day. A two-mile-long trail covering the ground of Gordon's flank attack begins to your right, at the end of the parking lot. Signs along the trail describe the action. If you have time, I encourage you to take the trail. Otherwise, continue your driving tour by turning right out of the parking lot and driving 1/10 of a mile to the top of the hill. There you'll see a sign saying Hill Ewell Drive. Turn left onto Hill Ewell Drive and proceed a short distance to the tour sign marked Saunders Field. Stop number 3, Saunders Field. Among the most appalling aspects of the wilderness fighting were the wildfires that swept across the battlefield. Ignited by exploding shells and the discharge of rifles, and fueled by the forest dry leaves and twigs, the fires consumed everything in their path. Able-bodied soldiers managed to avoid the danger, but the wounded were not so lucky. Caught between the lines and unable to crawl to safety, hundreds of soldiers perished in the flames. One of the fires occurred here, in Saunders Field. Throughout the night, wrote one soldier, as the forest fires, which had blazed since early afternoon, drew nearer and nearer to the poor unfortunates who lay between the lines, their shrieks, cries, and groans, loud, piercing, penetrating, rent the air until death relieved the sufferer, or the rattle of musketry drowned all the other sounds in its dominating roar. There was no hope of rescue. War's hard rules would not permit it. And there, between the lines, the men of both sides perished in the flames, because there was no helping hand to succor, no yielding to the stern necessities of war. Continue downhill Ewell Drive, 7/10 of a mile to the Higgerson Farm. The tour road follows a trench line built by the Confederates in 1864. Remnants of those trenches are visible on the left side of the road, just a few yards from the road shoulder. Stop number 4, the Higgerson Farm. Battles are not fought in vacuums. They're fought on land where people live, play, hunt, and work. And so it was with the wilderness. Situated on the battlefield were half a dozen small farms whose owners squeezed a living from the land, raising corn, oats, and tobacco, and keeping small numbers of cows, sheep, and pigs. In the field to your right stood the house of Benjamin and Permelia Higgerson and their four young children. Benjamin was more than 50 years of age and was home in 1862 when a sick Confederate soldier came to his door seeking help. The family took in the sick man, who was ill with smallpox. Benjamin caught the disease and died on Christmas Day, leaving Permelia to raise the children alone. The family was at home in May 1864 when Union soldiers of Gouverneur Warren's 5th Corps charged past the house to attack Lee's Confederates in the woods to your right. A soldier in the 149th Pennsylvania remembered seeing Mrs. Higgerson. When we marched down toward the rebel lines, we passed a small cabin or farmhouse with a picket fence enclosing the house and garden. Company D moved right over this fence and garden, smashing the fences and trampling the garden stuff under their feet. A Virginia woman stood in the cabin door and gave us her views on matters in strong language. She declared we were a pack of cowardly Yankees, that we would not go far in that direction, and we would soon come back in a hurry. We didn't pay much attention to what she said, but the result proved that she was right, at least so far as the coming back was concerned. We moved down into a piece of woodland and found the place full of rebels in our front and also on our right flank. We were soon driven back, and in going back passed over the same ground as when advancing. Our lady friend greeted us as we passed with taunts and derision, but we had no time to discuss the matter. In fact, she had the best of it, as we were whipped at that time, and she knew it. The farm road to the right of the sign leads to the ruins of the Higgerson House chimney, approximately 200 yards from your location. You can walk back to the house site if you wish. Otherwise, continue down the park tour road for 1 mile until you reach the pull-off at the Tuning Farm. Remain in your car. Stop number 5, the Tuning Farm. On the hill to your right stood Mount View, another small farm in the wilderness. 73-year-old William Tuning owned the land, which he cultivated with the help of his family and 13 slaves. Permelia Higgerson was one of Tuning's daughters. Tuning's farm was vitally important to both armies. For Lee, it was an excellent defensive position. Its high elevation offered a good view of the surrounding countryside, and its open fields provided space to deploy his artillery. For Grant, the farm offered unique offensive possibilities. Tuning's property stood directly between Ewell's Confederates on the Orange Turnpike, behind you, and A.P. Hill's Confederates on the Orange Plank Road, ahead. If Grant could seize the Tuning farm, he would be in a position to drive a wedge between the two wings of the Confederate Army and outflank both of them. The farm changed hands several times. General Samuel Crawford first occupied the ground on the morning of May 5th. Crawford commanded a small division in Warren's 5th Corps. He had just reached the Tuning farm when he received a dispatch from Warren informing him that Confederates had appeared on the Orange Turnpike and that the 5th Corps was making preparations to attack them. Warren ordered Crawford to leave the ridge and support him in that attack. Crawford was preparing to execute Warren's orders when he sighted a column of Confederate infantry moving up the Orange Plank Road past his division. He held a strong position on the flank of the Confederate column, and he didn't wish to abandon it. Warren insisted he do so, however, and at noon, Crawford abandoned this ridge and headed for the turnpike. After he left, Confederate troops occupied the ridge, but they too were called away to support troops fighting elsewhere. For the rest of the day, neither side occupied this important ground. That changed the following day. On May 6th, Grant ordered General Ambrose Burnside, commanding the Union Army's 9th Corps, to seize the Tuning farm and sweep down upon the flank and rear of General A.P. Hill's Confederates fighting on the Plank Road, a mile to your left front. The heavy woods delayed Burnside's march, however, and by the time he reached this area, Southerners held the ridge. Frustrated, Grant ordered his tardy commander to turn south, the direction that you're facing, and strike Confederate forces on the Plank Road. Burnside did as he was told, but again the heavy woods got in the way. While the rest of the army grappled with Lee in a death struggle nearby, Burnside and his corps thrashed about in the timber, accomplishing nothing. A farm road just behind you leads up the hill to the site of William Tuning's house. Exhibits there discuss the farm's importance in the battle. To continue the driving tour, proceed south on the park tour road for 1.1 miles to the tap field. Stop number 6, Tap Field. The Army of Northern Virginia advanced to the battlefield along two roads. Richard Ewell's 2nd Corps followed the Orange Turnpike, nearly 3 miles behind you, and A.P. Hill's 3rd Corps moved along the Orange Plank Road, a short distance ahead of you. The clearing on your right was owned by a widow, Elizabeth Tapp, and borders the Plank Road. The head of A.P. Hill's column passed the Widow Tapp farm on the morning of May 5th. For several hours, Hill had been fighting a running battle against Lieutenant Colonel John Hammond's 5th New York Cavalry. Hammond belonged to James Wilson's division and had been left by Wilson to guard the Orange Plank Road. A.P. Hill's Confederates encountered Hammond's 500 horsemen early on May 5th and slowly pushed them down the road, past the Tapp farm, and toward the Brock Road intersection, more than a mile to your left. Hammond's men, fighting dismounted and armed with repeating Spencer rifles, put up a good fight, retarding Hill's progress long enough for Union infantry to reach the intersection first. General Robert E. Lee accompanied Hill's column. When he reached the Tapp farm, Lee left the road, joining Hill and General Jeb Stuart for an informal conference in the clearing. As the generals discussed their plans, a small body of Union infantry came crashing out of the woods nearby. Stuart stood up and glared at the intruders. Lee walked off hurriedly in search of troops. Hill remained seated. The unexpected encounter surprised the Union soldiers as much as it did the Confederates. In an instant, they melted back into the woods, vanishing as quickly as they had come, thus missing an opportunity to kill or capture 3 of the South's top leaders. We'll return to the Tap Field later in the tour. For now, continue down the Park Tour Road 0.3 miles to Route 621, the Orange Plank Road. Turn left onto the road and proceed 0.7 miles to the Brock Road intersection. Turn into the parking lot on the right just before you reach the stop sign. Step out of your vehicle and stand with your back to the Brock Road. The Plank Road, the one you will have just traveled, should be on your right. Stop number 7, the Brock Road intersection. Meade's original plan, you may remember, was to enter the wilderness, then wheel his army to the right, attacking Lee at Mine Run. As part of that plan, General Winfield Hancock's 2nd Corps was to advance past Chancellorsville to Todd's Tavern, then swing west out the Catarpin Road. The head of Hancock's column was approaching Todd's Tavern, 4.5 miles to your left, when Samuel Crawford reported that Hill's Confederates were advancing up the Plank Road toward the intersection behind you. Fearing that Hancock might be cut off from the rest of the Union Army, Meade ordered him to halt his march and proceed at once to this intersection. Hancock was still several miles away. There was no way he could beat Hill to the intersection. Knowing that, Meade ordered General George Getty to hold the crossroads until Hancock arrived. Getty commanded a division in John Sedgwick's 6th Corps. He was camped at Wilderness Tavern on the morning of May 5th when he received the orders to seize the intersection and hold it until Hancock arrived. Realizing the gravity of the situation, Getty drove his men south along the Brock Road, arriving here about noon. As his column neared the intersection, Getty personally rode ahead with members of his staff to survey the situation. They arrived here just in time to see Hammond's cavalrymen dash through the crossroads and retreat. Getty galloped to the intersection and peered down the road ahead of you. By now, the head of Hill's column was just a few hundred yards away and coming on fast. It was going to be close. To buy his troops a little more time, Getty and his staff formed themselves into a line here and made a stand. The sight of the horsemen gave the Confederates pause. By the time they resumed their advance, the head of Getty's division appeared on the scene. The general threw his troops across the intersection, some to your left and some to your right, and ordered them to dig in. The trenches that they built, though shallow, are still visible on this side of the Brock Road. For the next 3 hours, Hill and Getty sparred with one another, but neither one made an attack. Hill had orders from Lee to avoid a general engagement, while Getty was waiting for Hancock. The arrival of Hancock's corps at 3:30 broke the impasse. Ordered by Meade to attack at once, Union troops advanced into the woods in front of you, engaging A.P. Hill's Confederates, who had thrown up a line of earthworks 500 yards away. For 6 hours, the two sides engaged in a bitter struggle, unlike any that they had experienced before. Smoke hung in the air, choking the soldiers, and making it hard for them to see more than a few dozen yards in any direction. Individual shots melted into one continuous roar. Unable to see or hear, officers lost control of their troops. Soldiers fell to the ground and began firing blindly ahead toward the flash of enemy rifles. One soldier described the confused melee as simply bushwhacking on a grand scale. As more Union soldiers poured onto the battlefield, Hancock's superiority in numbers grew to as much as 5-1. Hill nevertheless managed to hold on until darkness halted the slaughter. Casualties on both sides were staggering, Getty's division alone losing approximately 2,000 men. And it wasn't over. The next day the fighting would resume, as chaotic and as terrible as before. Before leaving this stop, you may wish to take the walking trail. It'll take you on an easy half-mile-long walk through the woods, past the Vermont Brigade Monument. The Vermont Brigade lost 1,269 men in the battle, the second highest total of any brigade in the Union Army. When you're ready to leave this stop, turn left out of the parking lot and retrace your steps west along the Plank Road, a distance of 1.2 miles, when you'll come to a small parking lot on the right side of the road. Turn in there and park your car so that it faces east, the direction from which you just came. The Plank Road should be on your right. Stop number 8, the charge of the Texas Brigade. Robert E. Lee was lucky, and he knew it. He had taken a great risk by engaging Grant in the Wilderness on May 5th, and he had nearly paid the price. Several times, Union forces had seemed on the point of overwhelming Lee's small force, but somehow the Confederates had managed to hold on. But now the danger seemed past. With Longstreet's corps and other missing elements of his army just a few hours away, Lee could now begin to think about taking the offensive. His first thought was to bring Longstreet's corps up the Catarpin Road, 3 miles to your right, attacking the left flank of Union troops fighting here on the Orange Plank Road. The ferocity of Hancock's attacks, however, made Lee change his mind, and on the evening of May 5th, he directed Longstreet to come up the Plank Road, directly behind and in support of Hill. Once here, Longstreet would replace the 3rd Corps at the front, giving Hill's weary men a much-needed rest. Lee expected Longstreet to be in place by dawn, but the night passed without any sign of his appearance. Hill's officers were worried. Their troops were disorganized and in no condition to resume the fight. Twice during the night they came to Hill, whose headquarters were here in Widow Tapp's Field, urging him to wake the troops and prepare them for action. Hill refused. Certain that Longstreet would be up by dawn to relieve his corps, Hill would not allow the officers to disturb his sleeping men. His decision nearly had fatal consequences, for when morning arrived, Longstreet was still nowhere to be seen. When Hancock resumed his attacks at 5 a.m., Hill's line crumbled. Individually, and then by hundreds, the Confederates came streaming back in this direction. On their heels came thousands of Union soldiers, intent on destroying Hill's corps and capturing the Confederate Army supply wagons at Parker's store, 2 miles behind you. Rarely had Lee faced such a crisis. Lieutenant Colonel William Pogue's Confederate Artillery Battalion alone stood between Lee and disaster. Pogue had between 12 and 16 guns in this field, and as the Union troops emerged from the woods, his men unleashed a hail of canister, clusters of small iron balls, in their direction. Pogue's artillery delayed the Union juggernaut, but they couldn't stop it. Union soldiers, infiltrating the woods south of the road, to your right, began picking off the gunners. Just when all seemed lost, a body of Confederates emerged into the smoke-filled clearing. Galloping up to them, Lee excitedly asked who they were. "Texas boys," they replied. Lee knew that the only Texans in his armies belonged to Longstreet's corps. Old Pete had finally arrived, and just in the nick of time. In a rare display of emotion, Lee swung his hat over his head and cried out, "Hurrah for Texas! Hurrah for Texas!" The Texas Brigade hastily formed a line of battle in front of Pogue's guns and began advancing across the field in front of you. The purpose of the attack was to delay the Union onset long enough for Longstreet to bring up the rest of his corps. It was nothing short of a suicide mission. 800 Texans against the armed might of half the Union Army. As the brigade moved forward, Lee joined the Texans, intent on leading them into battle. Unwilling to have the general risk his life, the soldiers shouted for Lee to go to the rear. When he ignored their cries, a soldier grabbed the reins of Lee's horse and forcibly led him to safety. No longer encumbered by the general's presence, the Texans charged headlong across the field, losing 500 men, nearly two-thirds of their force. At the end of the parking lot is a half-mile-long trail that follows the Texas Brigade's charge across the field. It returns here by way of the Widow Tap House site. Signs along the trail describe the fighting. I encourage you to walk the trail. When you're ready to continue the driving tour, turn left out of the parking lot and drive 0.9 mile to a pull-off on the right side of the road marked Longstreet's Flank Attack. After reading the signs, stand so that the road is to your left and turn your player on. Stop number 9, Longstreet's Flank Attack. The Texas Brigade's attack gave General James Longstreet the time he needed to bring up the remainder of his corps. Deploying his troops astride the Orange Plank Road, Longstreet advanced, slowly pushing the Union Army back to this point. As Federal resistance stiffened, Longstreet looked for other avenues of attack. On his way to the battlefield, he had crossed an unfinished railroad, whose bed ran south of the plank road and parallel to it, just beyond Hancock's left flank, a mile or so to your right. Longstreet sent the Army's chief engineer, Martin Smith, to check it out. When Smith returned with news that the railroad was unguarded, Longstreet dispatched 4 brigades, some 5,000 men, to strike the end of Hancock's line. The attacking force was in position by 11 a.m. As it moved toward you through the brush, Hancock's troops gave way in panic. 57-year-old James Wadsworth commanded a division here on the Plank Road. As the Union line began to unravel, Wadsworth's horse became frightened and bolted toward the Confederate line. The general gained control of the animal just a few yards from the Confederates, but as he wheeled to escape, a bullet crashed through his skull. He was the highest-ranking officer to die in the Wilderness. With his demise, the Union line dissolved. Thousands of Federal soldiers fled in disorder through the woods ahead of you toward the Brock Road, where General Hancock rallied them and put them into trenches that they had built the day before. Longstreet, meanwhile, prepared to deliver the coup de grace. But as he galloped triumphantly past this point, a volley fired by his own flanking force, occupying the woods to your right, crashed through the trees, striking him in the neck. Soldiers carried the general from the battlefield on a stretcher, blood gurgling from his wound. Like Stonewall Jackson just 1 year before, Longstreet was shot down in the Wilderness by the mistaken fire of his own troops at the moment of his greatest success. With his wounding, the Confederate attack faltered. It would be up to Lee to revive it. Continue down the plank road 0.4 mile to the parking lot that you visited before. Step out of your vehicle, but this time face the Brock Road. The plank road should be on your left. Stop number 10, Lee's final assault. Like Grant, Lee found the Wilderness to be a tenacious foe. For 4 hours, he struggled to entangle Longstreet's line and properly deploy them for an attack on the enemy's defenses here along the Brock Road. Hancock used that time to steady his men and put them behind barricades made of logs and earth that he had constructed along the road ahead of you. By the time Lee finally launched his assault, late that afternoon, Union troops had no fewer than three lines of earthworks, one behind the other. Shallow remnants of those lines are still visible between the parking area and the Brock Road. Walking on earthworks destroys them, so if you leave your car to look at them, please remain on the designated trail. After 4 hours of preparation, Lee finally sent Longstreet's corps forward at 4:15 in the afternoon. It was one of the largest attacks that he made during the war. Although no one knows for certain the number of troops that he employed, it may have been as many as 15 brigades, some 15,000 men, an attack comparable in size to Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. Like Pickett's charge, Longstreet's corps made a frontal assault against a fortified position defended by Winfield Hancock. And like Pickett's charge, it failed, miserably. At Gettysburg, Confederate troops had to cross open ground, where they were exposed to the enemy's fire. Here in the wilderness, they faced a much different scenario. Here they had to fight their way through tangled brush that clawed at their clothing and impeded their advance. Less than 100 yards from the Union works, they found their path blocked again, this time by Abati, a man-made barrier of trees and brush thrown up by the Union Army to purposely hinder the attack and throw it into disorder. As the Confederates fought to tear openings in the Abati, Union riflemen poured volley after volley into their ranks. Lee's men returned the fire, but their bullets had little effect against Hancock's men, who were entrenched behind stout breastworks made of dirt and logs. Despite these obstacles, Lee's troops did enjoy one brief moment of success. At the height of the assault, a section of log works, a short distance south of the plank road, to your right, caught fire, prompting Union soldiers there to fall back. A South Carolina brigade charged through the flames and planted its flag on the burning works. For a few minutes it held the road, cutting Hancock's corps in two. Union reinforcements quickly counterattacked, however, driving the Confederates back into the woods and restoring the line. Lee's grand assault had failed. During the night, both Grant and Lee fortified their positions. Both hoped that the other would attack, but neither did. Unable to break through Lee's defenses, Grant ordered his army to march to Spotsylvania Courthouse, 10 miles south, the next stop on the road to Richmond. The Union soldiers quietly left their trenches after dark on May 7th, unaware of their destination. In 2 days of fighting, Grant had lost approximately 18,000 men, nearly twice the number of casualties that he inflicted on Lee. From a purely tactical standpoint, he had suffered a terrible defeat, and most Union soldiers in the Union Army assumed that he would retreat. But to their surprise, Grant instead ordered them south toward Richmond and more battles with Lee. Later, as he rode past, the soldiers let loose a cheer. They had finally found a general with grit, a general who, despite heavy losses, would not back down, a general who would fight and keep on fighting until the war was won and the Union was restored. In Grant, they had found a general who would ultimately lead them to victory. This concludes your tour of the wilderness. Turn right out of the parking lot and proceed to the stop sign at the intersection. To go to Fredericksburg or Chancellorsville, proceed through the stop sign and drive 2 miles to State Route 3, then turn right. In a little over a mile, you'll see signs for the Chancellorsville Battlefield Visitor Center. Fredericksburg is 10 miles farther down the road. If instead you wish to continue following the armies to Spotsylvania, turn right at the stop sign and follow the Brock Road, Route 613, 8.5 miles to the battlefield entrance. On the way, you'll pass Todd's Tavern, the site of important cavalry action connected with the battle. If you plan to tour Spotsylvania Battlefield using a podcast tour like this one, start your player now before leaving this stop.